Welcome to the HR Power Hour, presented by Career Management Associates. I'm David Chulo. It's about all things in the human resource world. We're going to bring in local, regional, and national guests, and we're going to talk about a variety of topics and explain why human resource management is critical to your business success so that you can make decisions to keep and retain great talent. Welcome to the HR Power Hour presented by CMAcareer.com and Verrill-Law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo, and today we're going to be talking about a very important topic. That's wage and hour risks. And to do that, we have an expert with us today, and her name is Margaret O'Brien. She goes by Peg. She's the director of the Employment Law Practice Group at McLean Middleton. Welcome to the show, Peg.
Hi, good morning, Dave. Nice to be here.
Yes. Well, you know, we're going to be talking about something that creates gray hairs for most HR professionals and creates assorted other stomach problems for most executives. And that's the conversation of wage and hour. Why is this suddenly blown up as such a huge topic? It's kind of been this way now for the last few years, but it just continues to grow.
Right. It certainly has. And as I was mentioning before the show, I've actually had the U.S. Department of Labor issued audit letters for several of my clients in just the past few weeks. And, you know, some say where you have a Democratic administration, there's increase in enforcement efforts. But I think it's been going on for a while now. The U.S. Department of Labor and the State Department of Labor in all the states have been focused on different misclassification issues, independent contractor, joint employment, exempt versus non-exempt status, and just making sure that employees are getting paid all the wages that are due under the very complicated set of wage and hour laws at the federal and state levels.
I think that's one of the challenges, right? They are complicated. And they also, depending on the administration, kind of change the rules, to tell you the truth, on what is considered an independent contract, what's a joint employer. All these things continue to flip back and forth every 4 to 8 years, as depending on what administration gets in there. You know, how are employers really to be able to keep up with all this when they might feel they're in compliance 2 years ago, and suddenly they may not be in compliance now? How should they handle all this?
Right. Well, staying up to date, listening to radio shows on wage and hour, you know, attending seminars. The laws do flip back and forth on the federal level, but really in very slight ways on independent contractor joint employment. But there are many ways in which the laws are consistent year after year. So getting a basic understanding of the fundamentals is really important. And it's not intuitive. I always caution my clients that, you know, if I were building out the wage and hour laws, they would not look like they do today. They're not intuitive. You will not guess what they are. You actually have to study them. You have to read up on them, attend classes to understand all of the different rules. But once you do get it, it makes sense. You know, there are guidance out there. There are classes to figure out, okay, what does the Department of Labor considered actual hours worked? And what is the recipe for deciding what gets included in the overtime rate? So there are a lot of principles that are consistent year after year, and employers just have to educate themselves on those fundamentals.
Yeah, and that continues to be sometimes a challenge. You have a lot of businesses of 80%, you know, some say 85%, that are small businesses that may not have the time, may not have the team, or may not have HR. Right. I mean, may just have general people who are handling personnel issues or handling employment issues. And, you know, they're just making their widgets, doing their services. And you're right. It does require them to put in the time and effort to do that. If they put in the time and effort and they're really trying, does that help when it comes down to, you know, the oversight?
It definitely helps. There are sometimes, you know, back wages awarded, there are sometimes liquidated damages. That's usually a doubling of the back wages. And frequently that issue of intent, you know, whether the employer really tried to educate itself, can factor into whether or not the liquidated damages is going to be awarded. And Actually, to give the department some credit, the U.S. Department of Labor actually has a very helpful website that provides quite a bit of guidance on the wage and hour laws. They issue what's called fact sheets, and I reference them frequently just to get the basic rules set. And then the same with the New Hampshire Department of Labor, Mass Attorney General. The different states have different guidance like that, which is a quick and easy way to get up to speed on some of the rules. But I think we're going to talk about some of the more frequent ways that employers get into trouble, because really when I see employers get into trouble, there are some themes, there are some consistent areas. And so the Department of Labor sees that as well. You know, so they're kind of like, well, you know, we put out a lot of guidance on this to educate you guys. It's on our website. You know, it is there for you to easily find. So they're not always so sympathetic. But I find that there are just a couple of different areas that are the recurring problems for employers.
So we're talking with Peg O'Brien. She's the Director of Employment Law Practice at McLean Middleton. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, Educational HR Radio. I'm your host, David Chulo. We're talking about wage and hour risks. And this is, as I said, a very large topic, a big topic. And we appreciate Peg being on to talk about it. Okay, let's get into the three major problems that typically come the way for employers. What are they?
Well, I would say one big area is this big topic of misclassification that we're going to talk about. That's whether an employee is properly classified as an independent contractor or an employee, you know, your 1099 versus your W-2 workers. Another area is joint employment, which is sort of an increasing concern now because there are many affiliated entities and many entities that are relying on staffing companies. So this concept of joint employment is becoming more of an issue. And then that exempt status, that is a constant problem. Whether employers know it or not, every single employee in their workplace is either classified as an exempt employee or a non-exempt employee under federal law. And the presumption is an employee should be classified as a non-exempt employee. And so you have to usually meet a test to have an employee classified as exempt. And so that test that we know whether you have an employee properly classified as exempt is frequently a problem. So that misclassification is one area, big area for employers that I see. Another is calculating the overtime rate. It seems simple. Everybody seems to know there is a formula out there called 1.5 times the regular rate, but not as many people know what actually gets included in the regular rate. And so that becomes a problem for employers. And then another area that I see is just capturing all the time worked, you know, that you're actually monitoring when your employees are doing work for you. And that's become even trickier with this remote work arrangement because employees are at home and they might not always clock in. They might be doing work for you. And so capturing all that time. So those are sort of the three big areas that I see.
Before we get into each one of those, you know, I guess some employers say, well, how the heck do I get in trouble if I'm paying my people on time, if I'm doing the things that I think I'm supposed to be doing? What are the big reasons problems occur? How does the DOL, you know, say, oh, hey, you know, let's pick this company today? Other than obviously in this case, they know that you're their employment attorney recently and they've decided to do your client. So I understand that. Just kidding, Peg.
There are usually a few different ways. One is, I think most frequent, it's random. That the U.S. Department of Labor or a state agency is auditing in a particular area, geographic area. They're at a particular business park. And so it's just a truly random audit. And, you know, sort of within that randomness, it can be a little targeted. So sometimes a department is targeting the restaurant industry, targeting the healthcare industry, targeting construction, the industry. So they might be looking at construction companies in a particular geographic area. So maybe it's a little bit, it's not specifically random, that might be a little industry targeted. You can have an employee complaint too. You know, a disgruntled employee might leave your company and be upset and submit a complaint saying, hey, they're not paying for all hours worked or they're not paying overtime properly. And then the third way is a referral, cross referrals from different agencies. And I've seen that. Think of the 1099, the independent contractor scenario. So you're a company and you submit your filing with the IRS, and you note that you've sent a 1099 to a particular entity. And the IRS can see, well, that entity only received one 1099 for the year. So that raises a red flag thinking, well, if they only received one 1099 from one company, is it truly an independent contractor? It seems like it's only working for one entity. And so they might refer to the U.S. Department of Labor or to a state agency, even unemployment, to go and perform an audit. So those are the three different ways that an employer might see themselves, you know, with a visit from the Department of Labor.
Again, you're listening to the HR Power Hour, Educational HR Radio. I'm your host, David Chulo. We're talking with Peg O'Brien, Director of Employment Law Practice at the McLean Middleton Law Firm. Peg, the US DOL seems to be increasing enforcement. You kind of mentioned that a little bit before. Do you have some numbers to back up what's going on in terms of maybe why they're going out there so much more here in 2021, 2022?
Well, they announced earlier this year, you know, publicly by press release, that they were planning to hire 100 new investigators to help with enforcement efforts. And as I said earlier, you know, the rule of thumb is frequently when there's a Democrat in an office in the White House, that tends to lead to some increase in enforcement efforts. And last year, fiscal year, the U.S. Department of Labor had more than 24,700 compliance actions. They recovered more than $230 million in back wages. And I'll just say as an aside, in Massachusetts, the Attorney General on Labor Day annual report that she publishes on their enforcement efforts, and they recovered in fiscal year 2022, $11.8 million in restitution just in the state of Massachusetts and penalties against employers. So there's big numbers involved here in terms of the collection and recovery by the different departments.
So what would damages be available for wage claims?
When the departments of labor are involved, and so it's an audit, which is really what we're focused here on, rather than an individual's claim. But when it's a department, it's usually back wages, liquidated damages, and civil penalties. There can be also, you know, individual liability, you know, if a company doesn't have the assets to pay, something to think about. There can be individual liability. There can be criminal penalties. There can be attorney's fees awarded when you have those independent actions. So there are quite a number of different damages available in these types of actions. But typically when I see an audit, it's the three different types that the Department of Labor is seeking. It's the back wages for actual wages they calculate are owed. It's a mathematical formula. You get a spreadsheet of what is they've calculated is specifically owed, then liquidated tends to be a doubling of that amount. And then there can also be civil penalties attached to it as well.
That sounds like too much fun, really.
That is a lot of math.
It is. And it's probably just hearing the numbers, it can be very expensive for an organization if they have a lot of employees.
It can get very expensive very quickly. And really, truthfully, I so frequently hear employers say, if I'd only known the rule, I would have done it differently. But that's not a defense. You know, frequently, you know, we may get into it. It's for the overtime calculation. They say, well, if I knew that I was going to have to include that money in the overtime rate, I wouldn't have arranged the compensation plan that way, right? I didn't intend to be paying overtime on that bonus payment, for example. And so it can get very expensive very quickly.
Yeah, I think that's something we definitely will talk about here in the next segment as we get into the misclassifications and talk about the joint choice engagement and also exempt. So I think one of the things that I want to mention is that you said a very important thing, which is this is about making sure your compensation is right and that you have the right plan in place. And I think that's a big piece here to make sure that employers are doing it right and being thoughtful up front rather than just saying, oh, let's pay a bonus for that or let's do this for it without really thinking the consequences through. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at JacksonLewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
Car is a wreck and you don't know where to go.
Take it to Moody's.
You wanna get on with your life, get on with the show.
Take it to Moody's.
Good people you can trust and it won't be a fuss.
Take it to Moody's. Collision Centers.
M-O-O-D-Y. Your kid was talking on the cell phone, drove right through your own home. Sitting in the parking lot, maybe you get hit a lot. Driving through the green light, suddenly your side swipe. Put it in reverse, but it turned out that it was first.
Take it to Moody's. Take it to Moody's. Collision Centers.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, educational HR radio on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, presented by CMAcareer.com and Farrell-Law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo, and today we're talking with Peg O'Brien. She's the Director of Employment Law Practice at McLean Middleton. I will also mention that McLean Middleton is a sponsor of the show. We appreciate that, Peg, very, very much, because without our sponsors, of course, the show wouldn't be possible. So, you know, we're talking about a very important topic, of course, and that has to do with wage and hour risks. And during the first segment, you talked a lot about some of the reasons why employers can get in trouble in these particular areas. And so what I want to do next is kind of hit on the first one, which is misclassification, because independent contractors certainly have been talked about here a lot, probably over the last 5 years. You know, the show, by the way, this year is celebrating its 10-year anniversary. So I think we have talked about independent contractor and classifications till we're blue in the face on this. But the reality is that it's still a big challenge. And I think during the pandemic, during a lot of the work from home, there was a lot of blurring of the lines discussed. You know, are you really working if you're kind of doing your own thing and you're kind of doing stuff on the side, maybe? There's these questions. So why don't we start with a basic thing? What is an independent contractor? What's the test for it? And let's talk a little about what it has been or what it is today, if there has been some changes as effective of here September 2022.
Well, I think part of why this issue of independent contractor continues to be a concern for employers, and it will continue to be so, is because deciding whether an individual worker is properly classified as an employee or an independent contractor, that test depends on which agency is knocking at the employer's door. So if the U.S. Department is knocking at the door, the test for deciding whether or not an individual is properly classified as an independent contractor is one formula. If it's the Mass Attorney General's office, it's a different formula. If it's the IRS, it's yet a different formula. And you know, if it's the Department of Unemployment, it will be potentially a different test. So there's no uniform single test for deciding whether a worker is classified as an independent contractor or an employee. But I always talk to my clients and, you know, say, listen, do you have any workers who you have, you're issuing 1099s to? And I just try to remind them that under all of those different agency tests, U.S. Department of Labor, Attorney General, whatever agency is knocking at your door, the presumption is that when a worker is performing some work for an employer or a company, they're doing it as an employee. So you have to get over the presumption is an employee. So you have to get over that hurdle. And they have a lot of the same factors that they're looking at. They just might weigh them a little differently. But it's really about, is that individual really set up independently? You know, are they an independent business? You know, do they perform that task for other entities? That is one very strong factor. And then another is, who's controlling the work? Is that worker subject to an instruction or supervision? And then another factor that really plays into it is, is the work that they are performing, is it outside the usual work that the company is performing? So I use the example of a law firm. So here at McLean, you know, it would be hard for us to have an independent contractor lawyer because we're in the business of providing legal services. So probably we don't issue too many 1099s to lawyers. But we could have a marketing company, even though we have some marketers in-house, we might have a marketing company that we have a 1099, you know, builds out our website, for example. So it's outside of our area of work. You know, that company is independently established. And for certain, I'm not telling that person how to build a website, you know, so they're really, I'm not supervising any of their work product. So it's really kind of independent. So all the different agencies have the different tests, but they're all sort of looking at those same types of factors to determine is the entity really independently established. And their motivations are really not just about wage and hour, which is a huge concern for many of those agencies, but it's also taxes, right? Are you doing withholding? Is the government getting its taxes recovered? And it's, do you have workers' compensation insurance, which I always escalate as potentially one of the bigger risks that a company has for this misclassification. And there can be some benefit issues too, health coverage. So they're looking at, there's lots of different reasons that the government really does care about this particular classification.
So can you give an example of how an employer can make this mistake? I mean, let's take it through an example, if you would, of an organization that maybe did it wrong, or how they corrected it, or what happened there. Just kind of tell me a story about that, if you would.
This was several years ago, but I had a client that's a restaurant. It's actually in the Lakes region in New Hampshire. So if you know, every year there is a motorcycle weekend. It's actually
not
even a weekend. It's weeks.
It's a big event. Yes, it is.
It's a big event, right. And this restaurant, restaurant plus a bar, anticipated that it would have some extra crowds. So it decided to hire a security person to help, basically a bouncer, you know, to kind of watch the door. And this was a retired officer, and then made sense to, you know, have security there. They don't normally have security there, but they had security on for this particular period of time. And that officer then, retired officer then gathered some friends and they put together shifts to cover and but ran this work through the payroll of the restaurant. And really the restaurant was overseeing the scheduling, you know, even though there was a loose putting together of the schedule by the initial security officer they retained, because he really wasn't set up independently, right? He didn't really know how to supervise. He didn't really have a, you know, way to pay. He didn't have payroll, you know, functions. So, so even though it wasn't within their course of business, they actually did wind up wasn't their intention to wind up being supervisor and running payroll. It's just as this relationship kind of on an ad hoc basis developed, they wound up taking on a lot more of the oversight. And so when they were audited by the DOL, the DOL, it's really like shooting fish in a barrel. They just say, "Can show us your 1099s. And so they produced the 1099s for all these different workers. And they found that, you know, that those workers weren't outside the scope of your business, that you were doing, that you were supervising, you were actually even paying them through your payroll, even though you weren't doing withholdings. And even though there wasn't, you know, permanence to the relationship, it was during that particular time period, a permanent relationship. They weren't working anywhere else. And it really was considered to be pretty integral to the operations during that particular restaurant week or 2 weeks. And so, you know, hindsight's 2020, right? This could have been an easier fix if they had, they didn't have any established contracts. They could have had a contract. They could have really had it set up, not paying through the payroll. You know, they could have made that individual make sure set up a little bit more independently, that it wasn't just a side job for this officer, that they actually were in the security business. But the problem for my client in that is that they had some loose start and end times, but they didn't have any really official timekeeping records. And so figuring out then, okay, what is actually owed, was there overtime owed? You get into a bit of a pickle because you don't have those records created real time. And so you're at the mercy of the workers at the U.S. Department of Labor interviews to figure out those figures. So that's just one.
No, I can see that can be an interesting and frustrating, right, for the employer in terms of it. Of course, you're listening to the HR Power Hour. We're talking with Peg O'Brien, Director of Employment Law Practice, and McLean Middleton. We're talking about wage and hour issues and risks that our organization faces. The other thing that I'd ask you about is there was this Trump era rollout of an independent contractor test back in 2021. Has anything changed really now that the Biden White House is in charge? Has there been anything that has changed the rule in effect?
Well, when the Biden administration took over, they tried to rescind the Trump era rule, which I'll explain it in just a second. The Trump era rule wanted to make it easier to classify a worker as an independent contractor. They wanted to make the lines a little clearer because I think probably you can tell from our conversation already today that there's a lot of gray. I mean, that's a bit of the frustration, is that there's a little bit gray. And so the Trump administration actually wanted to clear up the rule a little bit. And so they rolled out a new regulation, and then it was finalized, and then the Biden administration rescinded it. And then that rescission was challenged in court. And the court said, no, wait a second there, Biden administration, you can't just rescind like that. It was a final rule. So a court in Texas reimplemented the Trump era rule. And now that's currently being litigated in Texas. What is the actual test for the U.S. Department of Labor on independent contract? It's a little bit up in the air. The Trump era said, hey, look at those factors that I've just been mentioning, you know, degree of control, the workers' opportunity for profit and loss. You know, are they really set? They've got, you know, skin in the game, the amount of skill required for the work, the degree of permanence of the working relationship, and whether that work is really an integrated part of the operation. You know, like, you don't need a security officer to run a restaurant. But so the Trump administration said, look at those two first factors, you know, the degree of control over the work and the individual's opportunity for profit loss. And if those two factors lean in one direction or another, like strongly indicate an independent contractor or don't, you know, there's a little bit of gray. If it strongly indicates independent contractor, then stop there and you have a proper classification. But if there's some gray, then move on to those other factors and figure out, okay, where is it tilting? Is it looking like an independent contractor? Is it looking like an employee relationship? And so really, when you're talking with companies about that 1099, it is sort of true that those two factors, when I hear them, and it sounds pretty solid, like the individual is independently established, you know, they're deciding the control of the work, and they've got, you know, the real skin in it. You know, they have an opportunity, the worker has an opportunity for loss or gain, by the way. Those do really typically indicate that you have an independent contractor relationship. So it is accurate. Those factors are really important, but the Trump administration put them as dispositive, and the Biden administration said, don't make it dispositive. We really want to consider all the factors to decide that.
Understood. You said the second one was joint employment. What is the test?
Okay, joint employment is another relationship. I'm not going to give you a nice, pretty answer because that's one that's going to be filled with gray to it and is heavily litigated. But it comes up in usually one of two fact patterns. One is that you have two affiliated entities. Let's call them restaurants. And, you know, one is based in Maine and one is based in New Hampshire. And really, they're owned by the same owners, you know, which kind of share administrative resources. But one is called, you know, the Maine restaurant and one is called the New Hampshire restaurant. And, you know, the U.S. Department of Labor audits and sees that employees are working at both of the different restaurants. And so you can see if it's joint employment, then all of the hours worked at both of those restaurants would be included to figure out overtime. So if they really are joint employment, if the worker does 25 hours at one restaurant and 25 hours at another restaurant, you're going to have 10 hours of overtime. But if they're completely, you know, if we're talking about, you know, work at a Burger King and work at a Dunkin' Donuts, those aren't joint employer. The worker just has two separate jobs, works 25 hours in one place and 25 hours in another. That worker wouldn't be entitled to overtime. You wouldn't add those hours together. So that's when the two entities are affiliated and are sharing workers, that can be one joint employment. But the other one that I'm seeing a little more frequently because of the particular economy we have now is the use of staffing agencies. So you might, let's say you're a hotel and you use a staffing agency to supply a cleaning crew. That's a different relationship where you might say, well, the staffing company has agreed to be the employer, but the U.S. Department of Labor might not agree, because if the hotel is really directing what all the cleaning people do for work and what their hours are, and maybe even give some supervisory instruction and training, the U.S. Department of Labor might find, nope, they're joint employers. You know, so both entities are equally responsible for the relationship. And, you know, the factors, again, you're looking at whether or not there are overlapping officers. You know, are there shared resources and do they share control over operations, and are the operations intermingled, and does one employer supervise the other employee? So you're actually, you know, the staffing agency is supplying, but you're really supervising. And so whether you're sharing clients and customers, so you're looking at this assortment of different factors to find out, are both entities really directing the work of one worker and benefiting from that worker's labor?
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back.
In today's highly regulated climate, customized HR solutions are needed more than ever. Career Management Associates can partner with your existing HR department for projects or even serve as your outsourced HR team. From compliance and compensation to investigations and employer relations, CMA provides you trusted HR solutions. Call 207-780-1125 or visit cmacareer.com.
If you're single and not dating on Match, then listen up. Match is not only number one in first dates, but second dates too. In fact, they've surveyed over 5,000 U.S. singles to get the top tips and advice when it comes to dating in 2017. Here we go. You want to impress a first date? Put your phone away. 45% of singles would be turned on if you visibly turned off your phone during a date. This is my issue, but the Mets are on it. It's like the eighth inning, and they're going to the bullpen. Millennials are 270% more likely than other generations to be turned on by someone who is binge-watching the same TV shows like Stranger Things or OA. Singles flirt everywhere, but flirting at the bar, in the laundromat, or at the gym are the most successful. I like to just say, hey, can I fold your clothes? Oh, see, now I get to I don't know, but I would like to fold your clothes. Dating can be difficult, so if you're not using Match, you're missing out. Start searching and connecting for free today at Match.com. That's Match.com, Match.com, MATCH.com.
At over 150 years old, Verrill has an illustrious history with more than seven generations of legal expertise. With more than 130 attorneys across seven offices from Maine to Washington, D.C., Verrill serves clients across the country and around the world. HR professionals, business leaders, and in-house counsel count on Verrill as one of the premier labor and employment law practices in the Northeast. Contact Verrill at verrill-law.com. That's verrill-law.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour, presented by CMAcareer.com and verrill-law.com. I'm your host, David Chulo, and you're listening to Educational HR Radio. Today, our guest is Peg O'Brien, Director of Employment Law Practice at McLean Middleton. We're talking about the very important topic of wage and hour risks. You know, we talked about the last segment, misclassification because of independent contractors or joint employment. The third segment is having to do with exempt status. So talk a little bit about what that test is and why this is such a frequently big issue.
Okay. Under the federal Fair Labor Standards Act, so at the federal level, as I mentioned, every single employee in every workplace is classified as either an exempt or a non-exempt employee. The law presumes that all of the individuals working in a workplace are non-exempt, which means they're entitled to minimum wage for every hour worked and overtime for over 40 hours, and they have to track their hours worked unless the company can classify them properly as an exempt employee. And so the usual classifications for an exempt are the white collar professional. So that means that worker is performing certain duties, is paid on a salary basis, and receives a minimum pay of, it's usually $684 per week without any deductions from that, other than
That's the federal level, correct?
That's the federal level. Yeah. So the exempt means they perform certain duties, paid on a salary basis, and paid a minimum amount. And so if an employer can't satisfy those tests, then the worker needs to be classified as a non-exempt employee. So, and I should just caution, many employers I find wrongly assume that because they pay a worker on a salary basis, that the worker is exempt. And that's not accurate. They can just take away one thing from this radio show. It's that paying on a salary basis is not the only test that you need to satisfy for exempt. They also have to be performing certain work and they have to be paid a certain amount. So as I mentioned, the typical classifications for exempt are the white collar exemptions: executive, administrative professional, learned or creative professionals, computer professionals, and outside sales. Those are the five different tests. And all of those different classifications have certain duties tests. And the U.S. Department of Labor has fact sheets. You can go on their website and see them. And there are a couple of other ways to classify folks as exempt too. There are different industries have exemptions, like the auto dealerships have specific exemptions, and commission-based employees can sometimes have different exemptions in agricultural. But it's the white collar that usually that we're talking about. You know, you asked why do employers get it wrong so frequently. The test that usually causes the most problem is that administrative professionals test, because employers say, oh, administrative professional. Oh yeah, they do administrative functions. If I pay them on a salary basis, that should be sufficient. You know, they're an office assistant, executive assistant, office manager. They are, you know, a finance assistant. They're doing administrative tasks. They must be able to satisfy that test. But the administrative exempt test actually has quite a bit of teeth to it. It's true that the employee's primary duty is office work. You know, it's non-manual labor. It's not somebody who's out building the widgets. It's somebody in a back office. But the employee's primary duty has to include the exercise of discretion and independent judgment with respect to matters of significance to the company. So the Department of Labor looks at, you know, is that administrative worker, is that person looking at different options and making a decision? So, for example, with an office manager, Is that office manager really working like a COO? Are they looking at different cleaning companies, for example, and deciding, oh yeah, I want to go with cleaning company A rather than cleaning company B? And they use their expertise to scout out the different options, and then they make the decision, or their recommendation has to have significance. They're basically leading the decision making. Or HR. Is it a director of HR? Is it a VP or a chief people officer? Is it an HR professional who's really deciding on policies, you know, vacation, leave time, you know, really thinking about different options and making decisions that strategically impact the company? Whereas maybe an HR coordinator, where they're really just following out the tasks of another CFO or HR professional, wouldn't satisfy that test because they're not really making independent decisions. So the test has a lot of teeth. It's been around a long time, so there's a lot of case law, but that's where I see primarily employers get into trouble is on that administrative exemption test.
Absolutely. So, you know, we said we would talk a little bit about regular rate calculations for non-exempt employees and how bonuses and other payments can, if we'll call it, mess up these calculations. Talk to us a little bit about this over the next couple of minutes here and tell us how to make sure that we get this right.
Right. You know, the U.S. Department of Labor, when they come and they perform an audit, they're looking to make sure that, you know, that you're obviously that the employer has a timekeeping, proper timekeeping, and is capturing all of the right hours worked by an individual, but also that they're including if an individual works overtime, that they're using the right formula for calculating overtime. And the overtime formula isn't just based on the straight time hourly rate. For example, if an employee works 50 hours and earns $10 per hour, and that's all the compensation they work, the overtime formula is easy, right? You just multiply 40 times 10, 400, and then the overtime rate is 1.5 times 10 or $15 times an additional 10 hours of overtime. So calculating overtime is easy in that circumstance. But what if that employee also receives a bonus for that week? So if it's a non-discretionary bonus, so it's something that the employee was working towards, that they knew, oh, if I built 100 widgets this week, I'm going to receive a $100 bonus. The U.S. Department of Labor says the overtime rate is the regular rate. So it's all compensation that the employee has received that work needs to be included in the calculation of the regular rate. So you figure out the total compensation the worker received for the week, divided by the total hours worked, and that's your regular rate. So I see employers get into trouble when they don't include those other forms of compensation that they need to in calculating that regular rate. And it tends to be bonuses that don't get included.
Does that also include things like stay bonuses or somebody who gets hired and gets a sign-on amount of money? Does that also include in this calculation?
Well, the sign-on bonus needs to be included if it's got a clawback. So if it's a sign-on bonus, you know, Jane Doe will pay you $20,000 as a sign-on bonus, provided that you stay for 2 years and work here. But if you leave earlier, then you're going to have to repay the sign-on bonus. So it was given to Jane with the understanding that she needs to stay and work there and to earn it. So it's compensation for a period of time. And so the U.S. Department of Labor will say, if Jane is a non-exempt employee and works overtime, that sign-on bonus actually does need to be included in the regular rate. So the U.S. Department of Labor published a new rule on this. And again, as a resource, they have a lot of material on their website that talk about what must be included in the regular rate, which is, again, the presumption is all forms of compensation need to be included unless it falls into a particular exclusion. And there's 8 specific exclusions, which you can find on the U.S. Department of Labor website. But it's usually bonuses, commission, you know, things of that nature that need to be included.
It's probably one of the biggest things that I see as well in terms of employers don't do that. And they don't even know. to tell you the truth. They just don't know. And to be honest, in fairness, we haven't heard a lot about it until recently, at least in the public notice. And I think it's because of the most recent information that recently came out on it. Again, we're talking with Peg O'Brien. She's the Director of Employment Law at McLean Middleton. You're listening to the HR Power Hour, Educational HR Radio. The other subject that's really important is the capturing of all hours worked for employees that are non-exempt or hourly. This really is a challenge sometimes for travel, for people who have their phones and use them when they're not working. How can an employer truly make sure that this is captured? Because the truth is that it seems an almost impossible task.
Right. Well, definitely having clear policies in place. You know, they do make a difference, you know, telling employees that, you know, the company wants employees to track all hours worked and defining what actual hours worked means and prohibiting any off the clock work, making it clear that, you know, the company doesn't want employees to do any work off the clock. If you do any work as a non-exempt employee, you should report it and you should make sure that you account for it. So having some policies in place and instructing on how to track time, and then having some good timekeeping software, you know, helping employees, making it easy for them to actually track their time is helpful. Sometimes you need a slightly more detailed policies. I don't know if you work with any construction companies, but sometimes a construction company in particular will have a crew that's going to a particular work site, but they need somebody to go to headquarters to get the tools. So then what happens over time, it winds up that the company thought they just had one person going to headquarters to collect the tools and go to the job site. But then it turned out that that individual and four others are actually at headquarters and collecting the tools. And then they might go to Dunkin' Donuts nicely, you know, but they go to Dunkin' Donuts and they get coffee on their way to the job site. And the company doesn't know about this, but really when those workers start loading the trucks, start to do any work on behalf of the company, then usually the rule of thumb is that all other work and travel time throughout the day needs to be included in their actual hours worked. So sometimes I find, especially with those construction companies, that I have to come up with specific rules to tell workers, hey, listen, we're specifically telling you, do not do any work for us at headquarters. You can go to the job site if you want to. If you need a ride, you know, it's up to you. It's a voluntary option. You can get on the job, but don't do any work for us because otherwise that triggers a time clock for the day. So sometimes I have to do a slightly more detailed policies depending on what the company is involved.
No, that makes a lot of sense. And to keep employees honest with their record keeping is really important. And it's the requirement of the employer to do so, is it not?
It is. It's the employer's obligation to track the time, but they usually delegate it to the employee because they're in the better position to actually punch in and punch out at the end of the day. So the U.S. Department of Labor doesn't require one particular timekeeping system. They just require that it be accurate. And so the employer just has to provide that guidance on this is what we believe to be an accurate system, and this is how we want you to comply with it. And if the employee doesn't comply, then it's a disciplinary issue, you know.
Makes perfect sense. You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM, and we will be right back. Educational HR Radio is critical to your organization's success, and our sponsors understand the value this program brings to owners, C-suite professionals, and the HR community. We are honored and thank our sponsoring law firms of Verrill, Sheehan Finney, Jackson Lewis, and McLean Middleton. Our partner sponsors of Healthcare Purchase Alliance and Strategic HR. Want to be a sponsor of the HR Power Hour? Text 603-303-6124 and say, we want to be an HR Power Hour sponsor.
Founded in 1958, Jackson Lewis is a national law firm with a local presence. The firm's 765 attorneys practicing in 54 locations throughout the U.S. and Puerto Rico provide a wide range of resources to address every aspect of the employer-employee relationship. HR professionals, business and in-house counsels, and C-suite professionals count on Jackson Lewis as it has one of the most active employee litigation practices in the United States. Contact them today at jacksonlewis.com. That's JacksonLewis.com.
Adopt US Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager, Learning the Lingo.
Today I'm going to help parents translate teen slang. Now, when a teen says something is on fleek, it's exactly like saying, that's rad. It simply means that something is awesome or cool. Another one is totes. It's exactly like saying, totally, just shorter. As in, I totes love going to the mall with Becca. Another word you might hear is jelly. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will think you're, rad, just the same. To learn more, visit AdoptUSKids.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
And we're back, and you're listening to the HR Power Hour. On News Talk, WLOB 100.5 FM, I'm your host, David Chulo. This is Educational HR Radio. HR Power Hour is podcast on all major podcast channels. You can go to hrpowerhour.com. Of course, you can go to wlobradio.com as well. We are today talking with Peg O'Brien. She is the Director of Employment Law Practice at McLean Middleton. We're talking about wage and hour risks. Peg, you've given us some great information today, important information for employers. As we wrap up this show, what are a couple of the takeaways? If people leave and they have nothing else that they want to take away from that show, what are a couple of things that they should make sure that they do right away?
I think I'll go back to the misclassification issues, because those are ones that an employer can perform a self-audit pretty easily. At least to get the ball rolling, and that's 1099. If you have any 1099 workers, go through and make sure that you're able to properly answer all the questions about the test. You know, are they independently established? Do you have an agreement in place? You know, is the work outside your normal industry? So really make sure, you know, act as if you've got the U.S. Department of Labor knocking at your door on each of those particular workers, and make sure that you have that accurately classified. And then two is the exempt status. You know, go through your payroll, and for anyone that you're not paying overtime to, figure out, you know, okay, why aren't we paying overtime? What is the classification there? Are they executive? Can they satisfy that test? Are they administratively exempt? You know, print out the fact sheet that the U.S. Department of Labor provides on those exemptions, and figure out if you can, if you had the U.S. Department of Labor sitting there doing an audit, would you be able to properly defend your classifications for those different workers? And it's useful because you might have hired somebody into a proper classification as executive exempt, but now the person no longer, for example, supervises two or more employees. So they've actually, you know, unbeknownst to you, they've lost that proper classification over time. So it's just handy to go over those classifications every once in a while. So those are the two takeaways I hope employers will take from this.
And of course, if they need to reach out to you, they can reach out to you at McLean Middleton, correct?
Perfect. Love to hear from them.
I'm sure you would. And of course, we'll have all the information on Peg if you go to hrpowerhour.com. And of course, you'll see her lovely face and bio and all that information when you go see about the show today. Peg, I really appreciate you being on the show. Thank you so much for providing information today.
Great to be here. Thank you so much for having me. I had a really good time.
That's awesome.
You're listening to the HR Power Hour on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and catch us every week at 10 a.m. on News Talk WLOB 100.5 FM or 1310 a.m. and streaming live at WLOBradio.com. Podcasts of this show and every show are available at hrpowerhour.com. Have a great week, everyone, and remember, HR management is critical to your business's success.